From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. New Hampshire Governor Chris Sununu is back with us today, fresh off his upbeat State of the State address, but also at a time of rising public frustration over mass shootings. And in his speech, the governor paid tribute to the latest victims, high school students from Florida. The governor said he spoke as a parent of three children.
I know, and I believe, and I think you share that belief, that if we can't put our kids on a school bus and truly believe that they're going to be safe, then nothing else matters.
Today in The Exchange, we ask what ideas the governor has to alleviate that parental anxiety, and we'll cover other major themes he put forward, including deregulation, Medicaid expansion, and New Hampshire's ongoing battle with opioid addiction. Also, his upcoming date to sleep outside on the sidewalk to highlight the plight of the homeless. As always, let's hear from you. Our email, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at @NHPRExchange. Or call in 1-800-892-6477. And you can watch on Facebook Live today as well. So check it out. Governor Sununu, welcome back. Thanks for giving us the hour.
Well, thank you for having me. Great to be back.
Well, let's start, Governor Sununu, with what's on a lot of people's minds, and that's keeping our kids, our teachers, our school personnel safe after yet another mass shooting. In your speech, you listed increased funds to help schools improve their security systems. Aside from that, Governor, what other specifics do you propose?
So, I mean, obviously what we saw in Florida was a tragedy, and it wasn't the first time we've seen it, and unfortunately, I think we all know it's probably not the last, right? We have to be honest about that. And you can pass all the laws in the world, but laws aren't going to necessarily prevent this stuff from happening. What we need to do is, I think, look at all the spokes of the wheel. So one thing we talked about was last year we were very proactive. Last year in the last budget, we said if we have any extra money, surplus funds, and we had nearly $20 million, we managed really tight. We're sending that back to the communities specifically for safe schools. Not something I'm proposing, something we did. And we've already put, I think, something close to $16 million out. That's about 300 schools will get money for security doors, surveillance systems, emergency plans, training for teachers, all these things that can be preventative when dealing with these matters, especially at schools. Mental health is something we've really tackled last year, and we got to keep tackling it. I'm a big believer a lot of these issues stem from undiagnosed mental health issues that we have with adolescents in the state. We just haven't done enough when it comes to being preventative with the kids themselves, creating support structures for them. Creating structures so they have an outlet, so they feel that there is self-worth, so they feel they don't have to go down this path. I think we've just left our kids behind fundamentally in that respect. We put about $15 million behind some of the mental health initiatives last year. We're going to put some more money at it this year, but we have to make sure we're dealing with this with the adolescents. People talk about gun laws, and they're going to be, it looks like there's going to be some gun debate at the federal level. That's probably where, if you're going to, our laws in New Hampshire are pretty darn good, right? If they're going to be more debate on firearms, it probably should happen at the federal level. Looks like that's going to happen. I'm kind of curious as to where that'll end up. But there isn't a one single thing that's going to fix this. We really have to, it's society, it's culture, it's investing in our schools and investing in our kids.
What federal changes do you think would be appropriate, Governor Sununu, or helpful?
Helpful is the key word, right? You know, I hear a lot about laws. Well, we'll ban this type of weapon. Well, we'll ban that type of weapon. We'll ban the. And is that really going to make the difference? Would any of those single laws have prevented what had happened either in Florida or in? Let's remember, it's not just the school shootings that we have an issue with right now. What happened in Las Vegas? What happened in Orlando? At the nightclub, whatever it is, there's a bigger issue going on here. Why is this happening now? And what are we doing on the preventative side? So I got to tell you, I don't think there is a single law. I think everyone's going to pass something and they're going to claim some type of victory on it. I don't know if it's going to fundamentally change anything when you look at the firearms piece until we really get serious about talking to our kids. And let's remember, something we were talking about. We're in a culture right now that's so divisive, that's so angry. Everyone wants to be angry as opposed to saying, well, how can I be a positive reinforcement in my local community to help the situation with the kids, with my family, with my coworkers, with my schools? It really is a multi-pronged approach we have to go after.
Well, I got a lot, as you can imagine, comments, voicemails, emails from listeners about guns, about school safety. And I want to let everybody know we will be doing a whole program on school safety on Monday. So I won't address everybody's comments right now, but I did want to share a few with you. Governor Sununu. Here's one from Jennifer, a mom, who seems to feel that tightening up schools is not nearly enough. She says, my son Robbie is 2 years old. He attends a wonderful daycare in Newmarket. He's a great explorer, loves to sing, jump, dance. Have you ever tried to make a two-year-old be quiet? Have you ever tried to force one into a small space so they would be hidden from danger? Jennifer says, it breaks my heart to know that this is our only strategy against my child getting harmed by an active shooter wielding an assault weapon. Jennifer says, why allow military-style weapons and high-capacity magazines in New Hampshire? So that's one question. And then, why did you repeal the license requirement to carry a concealed weapon, SB 12? So, Jennifer, thank you. And Governor Sununu, sure. Can you address those specifics,
well, sure.
Please?
So, look, we don't allow automatic weapons. Automatic weapons are banned. Right. People want to talk about, specific guns. And again, you can pass all the state laws you want. At the end of the day, the issue really has to be dealt, I believe, at a federal level. If they're going to do something, it's probably more appropriate at a federal level. Would any one of those laws, any one of those bans prevent those guns from getting in the hands of bad people? No, not necessarily, right? So my fear is that we're going to put all our emphasis on something that is a temporary Band-Aid without really dealing with the crux of the problem. You know, when we talk about some of the stresses that these kids are going through, right, we want to make sure that 2-year-old, my 5-year-old, is going to a place of that we can really trust. So it's about the environments that they're in. And that environment isn't just the four walls of the school. It's who their classmates are, what supports we're giving the teachers, what flexibility are we giving the students, right? What stresses are we putting on these students? Are we being preventative in homes with families? You know, given the opioid crisis that's going on right now, there's so much toxic stress, and that's kind of a general term, but I'll use it, going on within the home. So how can we be preventative and provide tools and resources at the family level? I mean, that's a big part of this, making sure you have a good family unit. And when that just isn't possible, what resources are we providing the caretakers or the homes or whatever it is that a lot of these kids are working with? So it's really from, you have to start early. And she's right, at 2 years old, that's when you got to get in and figure out what you're going to do early on to make sure that a small problem today doesn't balloon into a crisis for tomorrow.
Well, and I think she's pointing out what other parents have pointed out, that, fortifying schools, sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. Kids are outside at recess. Kids are getting on and off the bus. Some of these shooters operate inside the school, so they know the drill. They know the system.
All the laws in the world, right, isn't going to change that dynamic. I mean, that's the other thing. People have to understand, the government isn't just going to pass laws and make everything, wrap everyone in bubble wrap. Right? We can't do that. Look, if we could pass laws that would guarantee everyone's safety, we would pass them, of course. But you can't practically do that. So there has to be some responsibility on the communities, as us as parents, as us as members in our workforce, of saying, okay, what culturally are we going to do to affect a better change, a more positive outcome? Are we going to let all this anger that we see out there really drive our narrative in society? And again, it isn't just a societal change that has to happen. There are probably some practical things we can do, with our laws and making the right investments. But again, it's a multi-pronged approach.
Well, and speaking of laws that seem practical, there is one proposed law that seems to have some bipartisan support. Governor Sununu, 5 states have passed what are called red flag laws or gun violence restraining orders. More are now looking at these, including Florida. These are laws that basically allow the temporary taking of guns away from someone who a judge has deemed a threat to others. And as you know, there were multiple calls to police about this Florida shooter, his extremely disturbing behavior. But local police said, we don't have any mechanism to take this guy's guns away. As I said, other states are looking now at these red flag laws or these gun violence restraining orders. What do you think?
So we have a couple things in place right now, and you have to make sure the systems work. First, you have the criminal background check system that for somebody in obtaining a firearm. If that system is working properly, anyone with that type of criminal background that shouldn't be getting a gun in the first place shouldn't be given a gun. We have laws on the books that say that folks with mental illness cannot be having firearms. And so we need to make sure that those are being enforced. I get a little wary of just giving a judge the arbitrary power to go and take your guns because he says it's okay to do so. We have some of those pieces in place. If you want to strengthen those laws around mental illness, I'm all for having that debate. If you want to strengthen the accountability in that criminal background check system, which right now seems like that fit might have failed a little bit, there's some issue about the FBI and what they knew and what they reacted to. I think that would be potentially a positive move forward. If you want to make sure that our local sheriffs and departments Police departments and state police have the tools and training, so when they get a warning, when they get a tip, so to say, they know how to react appropriately and not to just dismiss the potential allegation and to take them seriously. Absolutely, we should do that. I mean, you've seen a couple of arrests being made already in New Hampshire on threats against school. We're taking that stuff very seriously. Those are all, again, pieces of this puzzle.
Speaking of background checks, New Hampshire has historically not reported people with mental illness to the National Instant Criminal Background Check System like most states do. And there's been a debate about this for some time, Governor Sununu, as I'm sure you're aware. Advocates for people with mental illness and others saying, look, you can't single out this one group. But now, in light of this, yet again, other people are saying, look, New Hampshire, you really need to join most of the rest of the country and put these names in the background check system.
So I think that system needs to be strengthened. I think that's where some of the hesitation is on the legislature and a lot of the local communities who have reached out. Because you're taking an antidepressant, should you be on that list? That's kind of a gray area. Right. Who's to say whether you have a true mental illness or not? A judge? A doctor? I mean, what's the real process there? And I think that's some of the hesitation, here in New Hampshire about are we going to participate in something that can kind of arbitrarily throw a lot of people on that list that probably don't deserve to be on that list. So if you want to strengthen that system, I'm all for that. If you want to make more clearly defined lines, so those with more severe mental illness that can be a harm to themselves or to others are clearly defined there, absolutely.
I wonder how other states do it, because most states do this, and surely people in other states aren't concerned about it.
I got to be honest. My personal opinion is I think other states don't have as engaged communities as we do. I really believe that. I think a lot of people in other states don't even understand how those laws work and how you can be just thrown on that list. And so, again, I'm not saying it's a bad thing to have. I'm saying that I think the folks in New Hampshire have said we need a stronger system nationally to make sure that we're not being to the concerns you just outlined. Those that are have minor mental illness issues, minor issues, aren't just being arbitrarily thrown on the list. Let's strengthen the system.
So how should the background check system be strengthened, Governor Sununu?
Well, two things. I mean, I think the overall, the background check system itself, I think, works better than the mental health, the mental illness system that we were just talking about, in terms of making sure that you're not throwing people on arbitrarily. I don't see why it can't work faster, and I don't have an answer for why it doesn't work faster. I mean, if you're in the system, you should be in the system. You should be able to get a background check almost immediately. Making sure that I think it's more about making sure that we're following up on a lot of these allegations. We're following up on a lot of these tips. We're really having that one-on-one interaction. I think a lot of times in government, we rely on systems. We rely on data tables, right? As opposed to saying, okay, here's an individual with this type of background, with this type of criminal history. Therefore, they shouldn't be given a firearm. Or you have some individuals that have committed very violent acts, right? But they get pled down. I heard this story recently. They get pled down to very minor acts, so therefore it doesn't kind of go on their permanent record. But they're clearly a violent offender, right? How do you legislate that? How do you make sure that those folks are potentially in the system? I don't have an answer for that, to be honest, but that's one of the debates that has, I think, prevented this from really getting solidified and codified.
Well, and speaking of, keeping an eye on people giving tips to police following up, Jennifer, our emailer, says, why did you repeal the license requirement to carry a concealed weapon? Local police told us, Governor Sununu, that they thought this concealed carry permitting process was good. It gave them options for preventing guns from getting in the hands of somebody who seemed violent, seemed threatening, hadn't done anything yet, but seemed to pose a threat. So some people felt like that was a protective measure.
Well, the folks that had the control over the permit, obviously, those are the chiefs in particular. Obviously, I always knew that they weren't going to be thrilled with it because you're kind of removing their piece of the puzzle. What we found was a lot of it was very arbitrary, whether you could go in and get a permit or not. There didn't have to be any real justification why someone wouldn't give you a permit. It could be that the chief simply didn't like you if he wanted to, and he was just going to hold up that permit and not allow you to have it. So when you heard story after story of that happening and you realized, at the end of the day, folks in New Hampshire are walking around with essentially permitted or now even not permitted concealed carry. It's been going on for ages. By pulling it, removing the permit system from being implemented at the chief's level, what we just took away was the ability for folks to make arbitrary decisions.
Again, the number for you to join us with Governor Sununu is 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. Again, the email address is exchange@nhpr.org. And Governor, let's go to Alden in Lebanon. Hi, Alden. Go ahead. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hello, Governor Sununu. Thanks for hopping on the show. I wanted to get your a more specific response to a question that another listener had emailed in that you seem to evade, saying that why allow assault-style weapons? And your response was that automatic weapons are not allowed. Well, we know that, but why should, as one of the students from Florida said, if the attacker was armed with a knife, he wouldn't have killed 17 people. I think it's not yet. There's no, hunters don't need assault-style weapons. Can you please say why allow assault-style weapons in the community?
Thank you, Alden.
So again, I think if you're referring to like the AR-15 versus a 9mm, who's to say an AR-15 is actually a 9mm can shoot just as, a semi-automatic can often shoot just as fast as an AR-15. Right. Look, if you're going to have these debates, it really has to happen at the federal level. I mean, we can nip around the edges on state law here, but at the end of the day, at the federal level, if the federal government wants to take up these laws and take up this debate, then that's a debate that has to happen at the federal level. If you think that just by banning an assault rifle, we're going to make everybody safer, I'm sorry, I just don't see that. I don't see how that works, because there's all these other options out there still, and you're going to, again, you're walking a very dangerous line when you just keep picking off one weapon after another after another after another. Eventually, you're going to get to the point where you are just taking people's firearms away. We're a very responsible state with firearms. We know a crisis like this could absolutely happen in New Hampshire. My focus right now is making sure that we're prepared, that we can be preventative, that we can be responsive, that the teachers, that the students know what's happening, and that at the end of the day, we're investing in our kids. That's where you're going to have the biggest, the most powerful aspect of what I think the government can do in terms of being prepared for something like that.
Well, Alden, thank you for the call. And he's right. A lot of the teenagers from Florida are saying, you know, we're not against guns, but do we really need these weapons that can just, you know, boom, 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 mow people down like that terrible incident in Las Vegas?
But again, an AR-15 doesn't necessarily fire any more rapidly than a lot of the 9mm out there. Right. So are we going to take those away, too? I mean, you're going to if that debate's going to happen, let it happen at the federal level. But it's a slippery slope. And I think that's why there's a lot of hesitation on both sides of the aisle to get into that detail.
Well, one more question on this, Governor Sununu. And then I did want to ask you about opioids, Medicaid, Northern Pass. But one more question on this idea of school safety, guns. At the State House today, there's a vote on a bill to allow anyone who isn't already prohibited by some of those systems we talked about to carry weapons on the state's public college campuses. I got an email from Deb, who says, will Governor Sununu pledge to veto the campus carry bill, HB 1542, that's currently in the New Hampshire House? And Deb, thanks for the email.
So again, if you start allowing the local jurisdictions to simply make their own rules as you go, you're creating a huge problem right there. You really are. You need either state or federal law to dictate the carry provisions. If somebody walks from one town to the other, if they're on a campus or they walk into a school, whatever it might be, you just run a dangerous slope of letting everyone make up their own rules. So, no, I mean, I think you need a statewide policy, basically, when in those circumstances.
So should college students be allowed to carry guns on campus?
If it's a public area, then yes. I mean, that's our law. It always has been our law.
Okay. Yeah. Deb, thank you for the email. And coming up, more of your emails, more of your questions, comments. Alden, thank you for the call. We'll turn our focus to New Hampshire's opioid crisis and some of the thoughts that Governor had in his State of the State address on that. We'll also talk about the Medicaid bill before the State House that's moving forward, and the Northern Pass project, the recent rejection of that project by the Site Evaluation Committee. All that's coming up, plus a lot of your comments, so keep them coming. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, Governor Chris Sununu is here. 1 year after taking office, we're looking back over the last year and ahead. You can listen and watch our show on Facebook Live today. And if you'd like to comment, send an email to exchange@nhpr.org. Facebook and Twitter is NHPR Exchange. The number 1-800-892-6477. And Governor Sununu, let's talk about New Hampshire's struggle with the opioid crisis. Mm. Hope for New Hampshire Recovery announced this week that it plans to close 4 out of its 5 resource centers not long after Serenity Place, the addiction treatment program in Manchester, went out of business after suffering severe financial problems. This news, Governor Sununu, about Hope for New Hampshire Recovery is devastating for people struggling with addiction. What's your response, and what role should the state play in ensuring that these recovery and treatment organizations are successful?
So Hope is a great organization. They have more people walking through the doors at Hope than almost any other organization in the state. So you want to make sure it's viable. You want to make sure it can sustain itself and it is sustainable. One thing that we are taking all of the different providers, opioid providers, whether you're talking about treatment or recovery, whatever it might be, we're taking them through kind of a financial review, right? I think Serenity Place was a great warning sign for a lot of us that there can be, financial problems there. You want to make sure that long-term they are stable. What are the outcomes and metrics that we're getting out of them? We actually just took Hope through that review, I think it was through December and January. It was kind of like an audit a little bit. The HHS gave their comments, Hope gave their comments back, and now we're going to move forward with the contract. I'm not exactly sure the amount. So hopefully that'll provide some more funds. Does it keep another center open or not? I'm not sure. But I think all of these organizations are kind of going through a period where they said, well, we were throwing all this money early on. It was a major crisis. We helped a lot of people. But now we have to make sure that we're sustainable for the long term. And I think that's what you're seeing with Hope. So we don't like to see any of these groups contract. But I think they're kind of taking some account of themselves. And a lot of these groups are doing that internally now as well, saying, OK, what's our model? Who's our client base? How are we going to get paid? How much are we going to rely on from the nonprofit donor community? How much are we going to rely on from the state? All those models are really – we're really putting accountability in the system. There's going to be some bumps in the road, unfortunately, and we're seeing that a little bit with Hope, and there may be some other organizations. My job is at the end of the day making sure that the resources are there and that they're sustainable for the long term.
Who's responsible for making sure that there is proper oversight, that these organizations are doing what they say they'll do, and that they have the financial resources to carry out that mission? Is there like a point person who says, I'm watching all this?
There kind of is. So that's really under the guise of Jeff Myers, the head of Health and Human Services, and we call it BDAS, the Bureau of Drug and Alcohol Services. They really provide a lot of that oversight, a lot of that financial oversight in terms of where the state funds are going and where that money goes. A lot of these groups, remember, are nonprofits. They're not run or owned by the state, so to say. We help fund them. We help give them some supplement and some subsidies to keep them running and to keep their models working and to keep the services being provided when they need to. But at the end of the day, a lot of these groups are mostly nonprofits. Some bill Medicaid. Some don't. I mean, that's one thing with Hope. Hope really isn't a Medicaid-style provider. Medicaid is more of a clinical type thing. So what are the outcomes that as a government we're going to want to see? What are the metrics we're going to want to see from an organization like Hope? And we've gone through that exercise. There's not a firm model across the country to deal with a lot of these groups that have that type. And it's a very successful model. It can really work for a lot of these folks dealing with where that type of recovery is the path for them. So we've really worked over the past 6-7 months to figure out what those metrics are going to be. Now that we've established it, my feeling is I think we should get a contract out to Hope in the next couple weeks, again, to help not just keep them afloat, but keep them viable for the long term, and maybe even help create a new model of investment on the state side for recovery alternatives like that.
Because involving Medicaid means you have to have sort of clinical
it's a whole mess.
Paperwork and so forth, and that's not their some model, so it's hard to get funding.
That's absolutely right. Some group like Farnham Center in Manchester, they do it great. They have a great system in place. Billing Medicaid is their model. It works really well for certain people. Hope is more of a peer-to-peer support counseling type service, which is so strong and so powerful for a lot of folks that need that long-term one-on-one support when they go through their recovery. So that's not a Medicaid model. Right, you don't necessarily want to force them to bill in their 15-minute increments. I have to move you out of the office because I have another quote patient coming in. That works for some folks, but not for others. That's not Hope's model. So, is it just the number of people coming in the door that the state's going to want to see in terms of the metrics? What are the outcomes? What is a successful outcome? If someone's been in the program for 2.5 years, if someone leaves the program, gets addicted, comes back into the program, is that a success? It probably is, because they're at least coming back in and they're recognizing it. But so how do you measure? How do you measure that? That's really the challenge that we're going through now. But again, I think we're leading the country right now in terms of, I think, being innovative to try to find how to measure that, how to get those data sets, and then how to share that data. If someone goes to Farnham or they go to Hope and then they jump over to Whitehorse and Ossipee, or they go to Phoenix House, whatever it is, do all those centers, are they all sharing their data so they can kind of track the individual, so to say, so they can see, you know, what medications have they taken, what path have they been on, what has worked, what hasn't worked. They're all nonprofits. They don't have investments in these big systems. So one of the challenges is, again, is how do we share that data to get a better outcome for the individual?
Well, it's a big task. And we spoke with New Hampshire mayors last week, Governor Sununu, in advance of the State of the State address. And we called up four or five mayors. We said, hey, how do you view the state of our state? All of them spoke about the toll that the opioid crisis is taking on their cities. And I want to play a little clip for you from Manchester Mayor Joyce Craig, saying that her city's Safe Station program is still overwhelmed. Let's hear.
We have started an educational program to talk with people about the services and opportunities in their areas. And that's really important because, again, Safe Station was set up as a point in time, as an access point to help people in Manchester find the help that they need.
So, again, Joyce Craig telling us that 65% of people coming into the Safe Station program were from outside the city or even outside the state. So what does that say to you, Governor Sununu, and what should the state do to help cities like Manchester not be overwhelmed?
I believe there are two real keys to addressing the opioid crisis. One is prevention, and the state hasn't quite gotten there. Now, we're creating a program right now that should be in virtually every middle school and high school in the coming months, and maybe at least by September. It's just a core program, so at least every student has something. And then schools can kind of put additional programs on top of that. But we have to be much more aggressive in prevention. The second is access. Access to treatment. Everyone is flooding into Manchester because the story is Manchester has a great access point in terms of Safe Stations. No judgment, walk in, get the services you need. We need those access points all over the state. It doesn't have to look like Safe Stations. Safe Stations wouldn't necessarily work in the little town of Newfields I'm from, right? We have a volunteer fire department. It's not going to really necessarily work there. So we have to find another access point, whether it's in the seacoast or the North Country or out in western New Hampshire. When folks have more access points, that'll take some of the pressure off a Safe Stations program that has worked very successfully. And again, we know the problems that Serenity Place had. Serenity Place has unfortunately had to go away, but we had other groups come in and seamlessly provide services on the back end of Safe Stations. We need those access points all across the state. And when you do that, you know who really takes advantage too? Women, families. Right? A lot of women don't want to come in and say, hey, I have a problem. They're afraid. Yeah, that you're going to be pulled away from
their kids.
Their
kids will be taken away.
Oh, I can go to recovery in Manchester, but I live in Bath, you know, up on the Vermont border, right? So I don't want to be pulled away from my kids. If you create an access point locally for that individual, she's much more apt, or that dad or that student is much more apt to go seek the help that they need because they feel like they can be connected to community, connected to family, and we all know that when you have those connections, you're going to get better results in recovery.
I want to ask about Medicaid expansion, Governor Sununu, please, because as you know, that's connected to this whole opioid crisis. Many people say, Republicans and Democrats, that this has been key in helping New Hampshire not lose too much ground to this. Senate Republican leaders, Governor Sununu, tell us you've been advocating pretty hard for the federal government to put forward some of the funding needed to make up the state's share of the program. So what exactly are you looking for?
We're looking for more resources, more flexibility. Those are the two biggest things that we could get out of Medicaid. The Medicaid, we need a New Hampshire version of the plan, right? For years, we've lived off this Washington one-size-fits-all version of Medicaid, which doesn't really fit exactly New Hampshire. It's been okay, and it's very much helped the opioid crisis. We all agree on that. But I think we can do it better. When I really got into it, and I said, well, we could manage here, we could save money there, we could reinvest money there. And we started really exploring opportunities. That's why I go down to Washington, and I've been down there quite a bit, because I'm trying to talk to CMS and talk to HHS and the White House and congressional leadership to say, by providing flexibility, by breaking down some of the regulatory barriers that, and it is a regulatory swamp, there's no doubt about it. The more I get my hands into Medicaid, how difficult it is to provide that. But they really want to help. And so what we're trying to do is say, if you give us X, Y, and Z flexibility, this helps New Hampshire. We have an opioid crisis. We have a more elderly population. We have a lot of dynamics in New Hampshire that are just different than other states. So help us create a system, or allow us to create our own system to take care of our constituents. So that's what we're really fighting for. And again, whether it's more opioid dollars in the door, more flexibility with Medicaid, if I save a little money, if we can find savings, can we recapture some of that to replenish the alcohol fund? And again, my commitment is, we won't fund the alcohol fund with $1 less than what was in there before, and hopefully some more by providing that flexibility. Hopefully we can get better match funding out of Washington and make sure people have more resources at the table.
So you want more funds and more flexibility Washington.
Absolutely.
So what's the backup plan, Governor Sununu, if the feds say no?
Well, they're not going to say no. I'm not worried about them saying no. What we're really doing is crafting through the details right now. You can have an innovation grant here. You can have a match fund there. There are so many different ways that the Medicaid money comes back to New Hampshire. The 1115 waiver, we already have an existing waiver. Can we augment that? Do we have to do a whole new waiver? There's a lot of different ways to do it. And that's really what we're going back and forth with Washington right now. And my hope is that in the next couple of weeks, we probably a couple more adjustments to the amendment to the Medicaid bill. But I think it's going to be something that everyone can support. I really do. And it's going to be a New Hampshire plan, not a Washington plan.
Now, from what I understand, the proposal on the table right now includes a severability clause that states the program would end if federal support is rolled back. So what's the contingency there for those 51,000 Granite Staters?
Well, again, whatever we get out of Washington, we'll get a commitment for the long term. Right. So
when are you expecting to hear? I know it's a bureaucratic process.
I talked to various groups all week long, frankly. I mean, in the next couple of weeks, I think we'll get something pretty concrete out there.
What's the role? You touched on this, but what's the role of state liquor sales in funding this Medicaid expansion?
So the profits from the state liquor sales go into something called the liquor fund. Right. That then of 3.4%. I want to raise it to 5%.
Yeah, which is what the law says. 5%. Right.
Yes. Yes. It can be funded up to 5%. It's right now funded at 3.4. Let's raise it to 5. That money goes into what we call the alcohol fund, which is not a very good name, considering that's one of our biggest vehicles to funding the opioid and addiction crisis.
Well, there is some irony there, and I want to ask you about that.
That wasn't my idea. But anyway, the money goes there, and then it goes to a lot of our substance abuse and misuse programs. So what the plan right now is, we're going to take that alcohol fund money. That's going to help fund the state share on Medicaid, and I'm asking the federal government to replenish the alcohol fund through a variety of different ways to making sure we're fully funding the opioid crisis as well.
All right. NHPR's Casey McDermott has been keeping track on Medicaid, so I will let her follow up on
that. It's incredibly complex. There's no doubt about it. But look, this is what management is. You got to manage better solutions.
Speaking of the Liquor Commission, as you know, last week you received documents from Executive Counsel Andrew Walensky alleging possible wrongdoing with state-run liquor sales. We've done a lot of reporting on this, that large all-cash transactions are being broken up to avoid federal reporting requirements. If these sales are violating federal rules by shoppers going from store to store to store, should the Liquor Commission, Governor Sununu, take steps to stop them?
Oh, of course. Oh, absolutely. And that's why we referred the allegations onto the Liquor Commission. We refer that to the Attorney General. And again, I was pretty blunt. I said, look, I think there's questions on both sides of that issue, but let's let the Attorney General figure it out. I'm not a lawyer. My office has technically nothing to do with it, but there's definitely questions on both sides. And if there's some wrongdoing on either side, then those folks have to be held accountable.
When you say both sides, what do you mean, Governor Sununu?
Well, the Liquor Commission sent a letter pushing back a bit on Councilor Walensky and some of how this all came about as an elected official going into areas of the store that he shouldn't have been at. And I don't want to get into the details because it's really not for me. But there were some pretty, I'll say, odd behavior there that the Liquor Commission had identified on their cameras. And again, it's up for the Attorney General to investigate that.
Let's take another call, Governor Sununu. This is Andy in Amherst. Hi, Andy. Thanks for being with us. Go ahead.
Hey, good morning, Laura. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Good morning, Governor. So my question is, I'm friends with a bunch of child protection service workers, and, everything that's happened in the past couple of years, we know all about it. It's been in the media a lot, and we know about the positions that were added in last year's budget. There's a bill out there right now, as I understand it, SB 582, that would implement caseload standards for the CPSWs and also add workers, because the caseloads are still too high, and the bottom line obviously is the families and the children, keeping the children safe, but the workers need the resources to get that job done, and I'm curious about your position overall on that, and also that bill in particular, and knowing that you you talked about the 16 positions in your State of the State address. As I understand it, those would be primarily to buttress the foster care program, which would help, of course, but it's not going to help with the caseloads in the short term.
Andy, so glad you called. And CPSW, I'm thinking, is Certified Protective Social Worker, something along those lines. And there is a huge workforce shortage, as you know, in terms
there
of
is.
Child protection, in terms of foster care, in terms of substance abuse and so forth. So I'd love your thoughts on that.
Yeah, so look,
Andy's call.
I made funding what we call the DCYF, Division of Children, Youth, and Families. I made funding that department appropriately standard from day one when I took over an office, which is why we did such a big push on it last year in our budget. We're making another push on it. Of those 16 workers he's referencing, which I'm pushing to get funded even beyond what we did in the original budget, that's not just foster care. It touches a little bit of everything. On the caseload stuff, I got to be honest, you got to be careful with caseload. My issue is more with workload. Different cases, we have a massive backlog of cases, of course. So if you tell someone, look, you can only take 12 cases, what you have to understand is some cases can be handled in a matter of hours. Some cases take weeks, right? So I want to focus on workload, making sure that we're having that balance. Should these frontline case workers be working these 12-hour days and these endless shifts and all that? No, of course not. And that's why we're making that investment. My hesitation with that bill a little bit is just making sure that we're really, whatever we pass is going to truly help the problem. It isn't just saying, well, we maximize caseload, so there we're good. It doesn't work like that. You got to really, again, focus on the workload. And again, that comes from the caseworkers themselves. They were the ones that told me. I went to visit, and they said, no, it's make sure you're being smart about it.
So they didn't want that hard and fast number, X number.
A lot of the folks I talked to, yes, said, no, it's about the workload. It's about, and when you balance, when you have a better balance there, you can manage better. We brought in all new management into that department. Joe Ripsom and Christine Tappan and experts from all over the country are now here on our team rebuilding our system to protect kids, and that's awesome. The second piece I have to throw in there, a $1.1 million into foster care, because we don't do enough for foster care families. We don't do enough to promote that. Also, preventative services. Again, for the first time ever, we're really putting a real emphasis on the preventative services going in with families and individuals saying, here are the tools and resources. Let us help you so we don't get to the point of crisis within your family.
Well, and we got a lot, Governor Sununu, from listeners on state employees, their pay levels, some unhappiness around that, also the fact that they don't have a contract. Let's play a voicemail that we got from a listener on the issue of state employees.
My name is Barbara. I'm calling from the Seacoast area of New Hampshire, and I'm calling to ask why our state workers here in New Hampshire don't yet have a fair contract. We really need to protect the workers in our country, but also in our state. And we have a problem as it is with getting enough good employees to work. So we really do need a fair contract. And I'd like to understand why we don't, what is the process involved in getting that to finally happen. Thank you very much.
And thank you, Barbara, for leaving that email. And Governor Sununu, we're heading into a break. So on the other side of the break, I will ask you about state employees, recruitment, pay, and that contract issue. And then I promise we will get to Northern Pass, also the issue of school choice.
I promise.
So that's all coming up with Governor Sununu. We'll read a lot more of your emails as well. So keep it right here. And also watch us today on Facebook Live. Check it out.
Some say love is in the air, but maybe it's time to say goodbye to your old ride. If you've been wanting to break up with your car or truck, why not donate it to NHPR? We'll turn it into the programs you love, like Morning Edition, Fresh Air, and All Things Considered. We'll even send you a $50 Visa gift card as our thanks. Breaking up is really not hard to do. Just go to nhpr.org/cardonation.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow on our show, it's our weekly New Hampshire News Roundup with host Peter Biello. This hour, we're talking with Governor Chris Sununu, following up on his State of the State address and getting his take on news of interest to Granite Staters. You can listen to our program and watch it on Facebook Live today, so check that out. You can send us an email right now, too, if you'd like, exchange@nhpr.org, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. And Governor Sununu, just before the break, I played a voicemail from Barbara wondering what was going on with the contract for state employees. This kind of folds into Andy's call about, you know, hiring more people to take care of families in crisis.
So on the state contract, we offered the Teamsters represent correction workers in the state, and they were the ones that we call the kind of the lead interveners, and they were the ones that really were not, I don't want to say they were holding up the process, but they were making some really strong demands on pay. We came back and offered a contract. I offered a state contract with 9.5% wage increase for that group
What, a year period?
For the new contract, right? So they would have gotten a 9.5% increase from the old one. They turned it down. They said no. So then we enter this phase of what we call fact-finding. It's kind of like arbitration, and that's where we are now, and that should wrap up probably within the next month. And so you kind of have this third-party arbitrator. So there's really no offers that go on during that period. This third-party arbitrator that'll come back and say, oh, they've made their case, they've made their case, we should probably end up here. So in the next few weeks, we should see where that comes out, and we'll move forward. So again, I think we've been very transparent. We followed the process. I know there's a lot of misinformation out there about it. But look, we offered a contract. They said no. We went to arbitration. We should be ending that pretty soon.
Got an email on this as well from Dan in Concord. You say state employees have received enough in raises over the years, yet New Hampshire DOT, Department of Transportation, isn't competing with other public employees. Dan says New Hampshire DOT highway maintainers make about $12 an hour or $13 an hour. Meanwhile, our larger municipal counterparts are making $2 to $10 more to start. While we both have similar benefits and the same retirement, please explain why your workforce doesn't deserve to compete with cities and towns. And Dan does give a couple examples, Governor Sununu. Concord, a truck driver makes $16 an hour. Salem, a truck driver makes $22.
Well, you just said it right there. So what's the standard? Are we going to match it to Concord? Are we going to match it to Salem? Are we going to match it to Newfield? Look, if you ask the state to basically, what are we going to do? Take an average across the state and we're going to set? No, that's a bad way to manage. That, you can't do that. So, and again, it isn't. I've never said anyone doesn't deserve anything. It's not a matter of deserve. It's about, again, what's available. We have certain funds that are available. If you're going to go out and promote a sales tax and an income tax, well, no, I'm not going to agree to that kind of stuff. We have to be smart with how we spend the money. Of course, our state employees are wonderful. They are so strong. They do incredible work. This is more, it really is more of an issue with union leadership at this point than anything. So, would we love to pay the state employees more? Of course, that if we could just hand out money, well, that would be great. But that's just not the way it works. So, again, I ask folks, people to understand, we offered a contract with a 9.5% increase for the correctional workers that were really leading the charge here. They said no. It wasn't me. They said no. So I said, well, okay. I thought that was a pretty good deal. And when you look at when you add salaries and benefits over the past 10, 15 years, it's gone up 70%. 70%. So it's not like the state workers haven't gotten any. That's over and above the private sector. I mean, that's a fact. So it's not like the state workers haven't gotten anything. You have to be reasonable and understand, you know, the dollar's kind of in the till, so to say. But again, we're in arbitration. That it'll all be wrapped up in the next few weeks, hopefully, and we'll go from there.
As I said earlier, Governor Sununu, we talked before the State of the State last week with a bunch of mayors around the state, and several of them told us they were upset about SB 193. This is the school choice proposal that will allow parents to use their state adequacy money to help pay for private education or homeschooling. I want to play just a little clip for you of Mayor Karen Weston of Dover. She says she's written to you saying, please don't sign this bill.
The city of Dover, the school department, and the city council have written letters to have the governor not sign that bill because effectively people can believe in school choice, but when they remove those dollars out of our budgets, that we are left with less funding, and very often the burden will be definitely on the taxpayers.
And we heard that complaint from other mayors as well, Governor Sununu. So what's your message to these mayors who are saying, don't do this?
This is one of the best bills that we could pass. And let me be really clear why, if you can give me 2 seconds. We have a great, I'm the first governor in 25 years to come up through public education here. It is a great system, one of the best in the country. But there's no denying that it doesn't fit for everyone. It just doesn't. There are some kids that don't fit in the box. So the number of students that will actually participate in this program is a fraction of a fraction of a percent. And to give you an example of a letter I received from the town of Salem, they said, Governor, this might cost the town $40,000 out of a $66 million budget. And this is going to provide doorways and opportunities for families and individuals that otherwise just aren't there. And when you talk to some of the students who have taken advantage of the scholarship program, there's some other similar programs out there, it's been life-changing. It has. And the Encarnaciones, who came to the State of the State address with me, it has completely transformed Angel Encarnacion and allowed him a level of self-worth, feeling good about himself, exploring opportunities he never had. And now this young man's about to go to college and hopefully explore a career in the Navy. I mean, this would not have been possible. So it's about opening the door for a select few. And let's also be clear, it's just the state funds that we're allowing flexibility with. All the local money still stays.
Still, right? It's about $3,000. So
it is.
It's a chunk of change.
So let's say there's 10 students in a classroom and one walks away. That's $3,000 that comes out of that classroom. That's about $7,000 or $8,000 that stay in the classroom for a student that isn't even there. Right? That local money's still there in that classroom, but the student isn't. So the dollars per student in the classroom actually goes up. That's the reality of what we're doing here and the opportunities and the doorways. Look, this gets down to the crux of what I believe government needs to be about, the individual. Are we going to be a government that just throws money at systems and creates new programs and claims victory with a headline? Or are we going to go to families and go to students and say, what do you need? What opportunity can I provide you as an individual? And therefore create a policy that doesn't blow the whole system up, but that provides an avenue for them to be the best they can be. That's what I believe government needs to be.
Well, thank you for, again, that comment about school choice. That was, again, from Mayor Weston of Dover. I do want to turn to Northern Pass. We heard a lot about this from our mayors as well, including the mayor of Berlin and Franklin, who were upset about the site evaluation committee decision.
Parents were crying to me from Berlin and Franklin because there were so millions of dollars that would have been reinvested in their local communities and their schools that now will not be there without Northern Pass.
Well, you expressed frustration, Governor Sununu, with the site evaluation committee. And let's be clear, you're not a member. You don't have influence on the site evaluation committee.
I have no vote. I have no say. I don't sign a contract. I don't sign a piece of legislation to do anything about Northern Pass.
You said that the SEC decision was, quote, pre-staged. What do you mean by that?
I mean that vote probably shouldn't have even happened for three more weeks. I mean, the SEC didn't even take up all of the criteria that they were supposed to review. I mean, that the SEC didn't even consider any of the concessions Eversource was potentially willing to make. Eversource got to the five-yard line and the SEC stepped in and said, game over, right? It just kind of, they caved to public pressure. They weren't even supposed to take the vote for weeks later, and no one even knew it was going to happen that day. So that doesn't just happen on a whim. I think they shortcut their own process. I think it was they really caved to public pressure, if you will, and they didn't see the vast greater good that a project like Eversource brings to a region of the country that has the highest electricity prices in the country right now.
Well, Melissa in Easton sent us an email. Melissa, I can't read the whole thing, but she basically outlines the extensive process she feels the SEC held, you know, signatures, petitions, hearing after hearing after hearing, more signatures. Basically, Melissa says the SEC spent months hearing from industry experts, citizens, business owners, and made the unanimous decision to deny the application by Eversource. They drove the proposed route, saw how this project would affect communities, landowners, and the landscape. The SEC, Melissa said, had the best interest of this state and the citizens in mind when they made the decision to deny Northern Pass. I urge Governor Sununu to respect the decision of the SEC.
Then why didn't they consider all the criteria? Right?
Only one. Sounds like Melissa's saying they did.
But they didn't. I mean, there's four clear criteria. They got to number two and said game over. Only two projects in the last 40 years were ever shortcut like that. Only two of them. Right? Why didn't they go to Eversource and say, what concessions are you willing to make to come to some type of an agreement here? Never even had the opportunity to come to the table with that. So, no, it was not a fair process. That's just fact.
You know, I've been watching this Northern Pass debate for 8 years now on this program. Did Eversource approach this in a helpful way, Governor Sununu. There's some thought that they kind of didn't roll this out in a very PR-friendly way and didn't listen enough early on.
I was critical of Eversource back years and years ago that they just weren't taking the right approach in terms of engaging with local communities, making people understand that what the facts were. They claimed it was going to really devastate tourism. Let me tell you something. I know more about the tourism industry than any governor in history. That was my business. The fact that all the lines were being buried through the White Mountain National Forest, right? They were all being buried. So, those facts really didn't get out there. And I think Eversource didn't do the best job of really letting the public understand and know what was happening. I don't think their consultants did a very good job. I think I don't think they hired the right people to advocate on their behalf in front of the SEC. So, look, there's responsibility on all sides, and I think Eversource has to take some of the responsibility for that. Is the project completely dead? I don't know.
That's going to be my question. What happens next?
I think they're appealing it through a court process, basically saying that we just didn't get our fair day. They're not appealing the vote as much as they're saying this wasn't a fair process, and I think they have every right to do that.
Well, Bob in Sunapee says the site evaluation committee should be more concerned with new industry not coming to New Hampshire because of high electric rates, the jobs Northern Pass would create, than they are about the tourism factor. Bob says, I do not believe the tourism industry will be affected by Northern Pass. Our beautiful mountains, lakes, foliage, and natural beauty will still bring visitors to the state.
This line was going through, 91% of the Northern Pass line was going through an existing corridor. Like, we weren't like shaving a line through the forest, so to say. That's a big myth. I heard from businesses very directly that said, Governor, maybe we're done. Maybe we have to move south. And that made me nervous because they're kind of throwing their hands up saying, if one organization can thwart all the potential progress we can have in saving money on electric rates, then how do we budget for that long term?
Okay, but there are other projects out there, and a bipartisan group of lawmakers has asked for your support of one of these, National Grid's Granite State Power Link. What do you think, Governor?
Well, I'm not going to go out and endorse any project. Northern Pass is a project that's been out there for years. I understand it. I've been very strongly behind it because I saw the very direct benefits to the state of New Hampshire. I think Granite State Power Link could be a very good project. I think there's a lot of projects out there that could be very good. I've always said Northern Pass wasn't going to be it was just a piece of the puzzle. It wasn't going to be the end-all, be-all of lowering electric rates. We need more natural gas. We need smarter renewable energy. We need to explore new ways to bring baseload generation up. People have to appreciate we are losing power plants almost every year here in New England, and that really affects your rates. At the end of the day, all of our natural gas comes through a pipeline through Albany, New York. They control the valve. So how are we going to make sure that we're there in the long term and we're getting those natural resources here to keep energy rates low?
A couple last questions for you, Governor Sununu. Hard to believe we have about 3 or 4
goes
minutes
so fast.
Left. It does go fast.
It's like Christmas.
Sometimes that's not such a bad thing. You appointed a Millennial Advisory Council to give you advice on attracting and retaining that young workforce that everybody talks about. What are you learning from this council?
Oh, it's been great. They put together a report for us with some great ideas. They helped write part of the Amazon proposal. They've brought up ideas about housing. I'm proposing a tax credit for first-time home buyers, which I think can spur millennials to come in and make that investment here in New Hampshire. They talked about not just workforce issues and how to drive workforce, but what they want to see in terms of their lifestyle, their culture, right? What's important to them? And when you know that, you can then go market to it. This state has never done a good job of going down to Massachusetts or down to to other states and driving a message to drive workforce in here. We kind of take it for granted. I want to be that promoter. And I think both myself and the business industry, working with the university system, we all need to be promoting a good message. And that Millennial Council is really providing the backbone of what that message is going to be.
Have they changed your mind on anything?
I wouldn't say changed my mind, but enlightened me, right? So I might be the youngest governor in the country, but even I don't necessarily
understand. You don't count for millennials.
Well, no, I don't necessarily understand what makes all the millennials tick, so to say. So, and I don't think any of us do. So we want to get into that. What is Generation Z, they call it, the real college students now, that next generation, what are they looking for? Because their variables of how they make their life decisions are very different. So when you put all those pieces together, the best thing you do is go talk to the stakeholders and go get some ideas from them directly.
Did they talk to you, Governor? Sununu, about rail. There's been a lot of talk about, at first you were opposed and then you said, hey, let's study it. And then more recently, I got some communication that said
the legislature pulled it out,
and that you were supportive of the legislature pulling it out of the 10-year plan.
Well, so what happened there was again, the rail project is like $300 million project with long term subsidies. When Amazon wanted to come in, they said, "Well, if we're going to potentially come in, we want rail." And I said, "Well, absolutely. If you're willing to make a $5 billion investment, let's start studying that and putting it on the table." So I put it into the 10-year plan. That was the main catalyst for Amazon was the main catalyst for doing that.
Again, that's a 10-year transportation plan.
10-year transportation plan. That's in the legislature's hands right now, and they've pulled it out. And I had a couple legislatures come up to me and say, you know, Governor, we might kill that rail. And I said, well, that's your decision. I mean, I can't prevent that.
But
that's
you really have a bully pulpit. I mean, if you really wanted rail, you
well,
could
I put
say,
it
no,
in.
No, put, yeah.
Well, obviously, I put it in, so they knew I wanted to go in. But look, the legislature always manipulates the 10-year plan, and that's fine. There's a private rail group that wants to come in, no dollars from the government. Interesting idea and proposal, all privately run and funded. I think that's something that we can still explore. So there's still some options on the table.
Well, we've done whole programs on that. I'll let that aside for now. A quick question for you, Governor Sununu, on the issue of sexual harassment. Lots of attention to this in the workplace here in New Hampshire. Lots of attention recently to the fact that at a voluntary training on this for the legislature, almost nobody showed up.
I was surprised at that.
Should this be mandatory, as some lawmakers now say it should be?
Look, I consider the State House a workplace. I do. And most workplaces have mandatory aspects of sexual harassment policy. We have one in our office in the
sure,
executive branch, of course.
Sure, we've got one here at NHPR.
So, you know, I think it's something that the legislature needs to really consider. Absolutely.
Consider making it voluntary.
I mean mandatory. Yeah, I think they should. Yeah.
One last question for you. At your State of the State address, you announced—
I mean, they have staff, right?
Yeah.
They have employees that they rely on. It is a workplace. That makes common sense to me. I mean, I'm not sure what they'll end up doing, but—
Do you have the authority as governor to tell them, lawmakers, you need
no.
to make this mandatory?
No,
it's
no.
It's because that's the legislative
their own body.
Branch.
They make their own rules. Yeah.
But you think that they should make it mandatory, if you were to give your opinion.
I think that any workplace should make it mandatory.
At your State of the State address, Governor Sununu, you announced your plan to sleep out overnight next month to call attention to the plight
of youth
homelessness.
And you're going to join me, right? Maybe?
I need to look at my calendar.
I shouldn't have done that. I should not have put you on the spot like
that's
that,
all
but
right.
I was excited.
That's all right. You cause a little stir in the room by inviting all the state commissioners to join you. When is the sleep out?
Inviting them, forcing them. Who knows?
And any takers yet?
Yeah, so March 23rd. Look, Borja Alvarez de Toledo has created this, the 2018 sleep out. I was there last year. They had about 80 people that actually slept out. And I said, boy, if I be, you know, as governor, I want to make this something real. And I want to put some emphasis on it and some activism, so to say. So I invited, and maybe I'll coerce and semi-force, all my commissioners to join me and their leadership teams as well.
So it's about a month away.
It's about
anybody,
a month away.
Who's going to do it?
Anyone can come. I'm assuming, you know, when I announced it, I saw Frank Adelblut, the commissioner of education, almost jump out of his seat. He was so excited. He was cheering literally into the rafters because he gets it. He understands this. There are issues out there, whether you're talking about homelessness or abused kids or whatever it might be. Sometimes, again, the community supports are the strongest. So we, as elected officials, as leadership in the state, it's our obligation to really drive the right message and saying, let's talk about this. The fact that you have 300 kids at any given time sleeping out on the streets. We're going to put some emphasis behind it, hopefully raise some money and awareness, and really start tackling the issue. One is too many.
You hiked the Appalachian Trail. What kind of sleeping bag?
-5 degree sleeping bag.
That's what you're going to take.
Yeah, bro. Who knows? Yeah.
All right. Governor Sununu, I got to wrap it up there.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. We'll talk
great.
To you again.
Thank you.
That's New Hampshire Governor Chris Sununu. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.